It's the Department of Science edition of Radio Free Thinker. This week, inadvertent science censorship, America's Asian connection, suey choppers, and more than traditional medicine. Let's begin episode 163.
It's time for Radio Free Thinker, the show that applies skepticism and critical thinking to everyday issues. Place where reason and reality cross sword, politics, religion, economics, and of course, science. Now let's get ready to be skeptical.
The cosmos is also within us. We're made of smart stuff. We are aware of the cosmos to know itself.
Across the sea of space, the stars are others, and we have traveled this way before. And there is much to be learned.
Hello and welcome to Radio Free Thinker, the radio show podcast that promotes skepticism and critical thinking, right here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. This is Ethan, your freethinking historian.
And this is Don, your political science philosopher. Well, it looks like we've finally done it. It's a high bar to clear, but we made it. What, you might ask? Well, at least in one regard, Canada is more screwy than the U.S., I don't know if you've heard about this, Ethan, about an author in Ottawa who's trying to get some information about science, and our government just put up roadblock after roadblock to sort of, well, not overtly censor him, but accidentally censor, I guess would be the word. I was reading in the Ottawa Herald about this author who was simply trying to get an interview with a Canadian science that was employed by the government, or, well, at least funded by the National Research Council. The reporter, Tom Spears, apparently had read about some research NASA was doing about measuring snowfall. He learned that NASA had teamed up with Environment Canada, the NRC, and several universities to fly through and over falling snow in southern Ontario this winter. It used some specialized equipment to analyze falling snow in different weather conditions, ideally to create better modeling and better navigational tools for knowing where and how much snow is falling. He contacted NASA and was talking to one of the research scientists in about 15 minutes. Now, being a proud Canadian, Spears wanted to get the Canadian angle, which he thought would be interesting considering the significant contribution we had in the project. In the U.S., again, he could just contact the science directly. Harper, however, has put an end to that tomfoolery here in Canada. To talk to a government-related scientist in Canada, you have to put in a request with the federal department, which he did. After waiting about 2 days, Spears had to publish without his interview, nor the information he was really hoping to include. Curious about how the agency had handled his request, he filed a Freedom of Information request, and he received over 50 pages for this sort of simple request that he had done. The long and the short of it, the lower government agents wanted to just arrange an interview promptly, but got shot down by more senior management who thought it wasn't appropriate or necessary, and simply wanted to give a couple of paragraphs or four about the technical details, you know, things like what plane was used, how many pieces of equipment were on there.
Well, I mean, doesn't this sort of harken back to the debate we were having, I think, a couple months ago when the discussion or the new rules regarding the ability of scientists to communicate with media without going through sort of a government liaison beforehand was sort of causing a lot of concern, especially within the sort of science community in Canada. And I think that a lot of various scientists and there were a lot of like advocacy groups saying this is ridiculous. You're putting a roadblock between science and the public. And of course, that's a very important connection because we need the public to be informed and also have some access to our scientific accomplishments. And if they have to go through a government interpreter every time they want to, you know, get an interview, that's really going to make science reporting abysmal in Canada. So this is actually a pretty good example of science reporting becoming really crappy in Canada.
And the fact, you know, that as you're saying, one of the big areas that we need to improve upon is to get the public informed and educated about the science itself. I mean, we do tend to be doing good science, but the population in general tends to be rather ignorant about that particular science itself. And it's ironic too, because out of this, right, when Spears finally wrote his article, he kind of did a perfunctory, Oh, yes, and the NRC was involved in as well. In the documents that he got in this Freedom of Information, they had mentioned the small mention that was given to the agency and the actual absence of any of the Canadian scientific contribution to the project. But they thought it was okay because they didn't think the journalists really wanted any of that information anyhow, but just a confirmation that they were involved, which, of course, is not what he wanted at all. And I think where this gets scary in some degrees is this sort of knee-jerk reaction to just less information is better. And that, you know, given the choice between giving him a lot of information or giving him next to nothing, we're just safer not to. Because, I mean, it wasn't like this was like greenhouse gases or the salmon fishing where there's a lot of political weight to it, you know, where what a scientist says, especially a quote-unquote government-employed scientist, could have political ramifications beyond the actual scientific information. This was a sort of feel-good sort of snowfall story, and it just like out of habit, they figured, let's just censor this and keep it as to a minimum.
Yeah, really, really ridiculous situation, and I mean, really kind of shows sort of the level of inaction amongst the government and sort of, you know, its new role as science censor, but also really demonstrates why, you know, these laws and these regulations pertaining to going through a government liaison is just so worthless. I mean, I'm sure this is creating a lot more problems than it actually is solving in any sense of the imagination. So I don't know, just a really, you know, bad turn of events for science reporting in Canada.
You know, it's actually interesting too, because thanks to these documents, again, what should have been a rather simple thing, I say, in to contact the American scientist, he just tracked down the name and called them. But here we had at least, I think it was about 5 or 6 bureaucrats who were sort of filtering the information and in the process doing a bad job of it. And it just, it adds to the paperwork. And our governments keep saying, you know, we need to streamline our processes, we need to cut back. And here's a perfect example where not only are we sort of wasting money in this one area, but we're also hurting society by, in essence, dumbing down. As the reporter had sort of knew, there was a lot of good Canadian science that he wanted to include in this, but it just wasn't available to him. It was sad.
Absolutely. I mean, that aspect of denying the public a real connection to this science journalism, which in most cases is usually very difficult to establish because, you know, when it comes to a lot of science, it generally does go over people's head. I mean, we do live in a very sort of science illiterate society. And without some kind of like connection that allows you to you know, feel some kind of relation to the story or whether the material jumps out at you or for whatever reason, you know, I think people really appreciate having that aspect of it. But with this case particular, I mean, it just kind of, you're right, it kind of dumbed down the receptive audience to a point where they're kind of like, oh, you know, weird science story, I can't be bothered to read this. But if they had that connection, they might actually take the time to look at it and learn about it and, you know, eventually, you know, get a little bit smarter about science.
This kind of gives me a question I can ask you, Ethan. Recently, there was some research done into bird flu in the United States, and they wanted to publish a paper, and essentially the government had said, no, you can't. And the scientific consensus sort of said, well, maybe that's a good thing. So I think this is a very good case of where censorship of science has gone awry. But how do you think you would sort of square the circle? I mean, how would you, in your own personal thoughts, figure some information maybe should be censored, or we don't want, you know, all scientists to just kind of go off half-cocked, especially if they're representing the government. How would you sort of draw the line or make a distinction?
Well, I guess it depends on the circumstances of each particular case. Like, you know, if, in the case of talking about like bird flu or anything that could potentially, say, be weaponized or in that form, there certainly should be a bit more caution, I think. I mean, after all, you know, there's a certain level of markability, I suppose we could say, for any science story. Who is the primary audience of this story? And will that audience find the story interesting? Will that audience find the story insightful? What will they gain out of it? So for a story about, say, bird flu or whatever it could be. Maybe it's, you know, how to build a nuclear bomb or something like that. The audience for that may not be the target audience of either the journalist or the scientist. And in that particular case, you know, it's going to take some careful scrutiny about, you know, who is our audience and what are we giving them in terms of content? Are we giving them information that's going to excite them and make them more interested in science? Or are we giving them the blueprints for a very bad bomb? And of course, that's not going to come up in every case, but it's going to be something that they're going to have to think about. Now, does that imply that we need government censorship in place to ensure that doesn't happen? I would like to hope not. I mean, I'd like to hope that most scientists are not that, you know, sort of maniacal to release really sensitive information just willy-nilly into the public. And the other, you know, other sort of flip side is, well, what if these scientists have, say, an interesting discovery? Interesting can be to them and people in their field, but for the average person is really not that interesting. Like, you know, maybe it has something to do with like mold and rocks and something like that. And, you know, it's, oh, okay, well, that's interesting, but it's not that interesting. And if that is sort of released without some level of perhaps poetic license, it's not going to excite anybody. It's actually going to make them kind of bored and perhaps even like a little standoffish the next time they see a science story. It does help to have that kind of second moment of thought to go, okay, well, maybe this story isn't the story that we should be leading out with. Maybe we should either find something that's a bit more exciting or perhaps something that's not too inflammatory that's going to perhaps, you know, have some bad consequences in the future. So, I mean, I guess what it comes down to is the people who present these stories, they have to be a little bit versed in sort of public relations and what people are going to find interesting and what people want to read about, which I don't know if they cover that in many science classes.
So essentially you're kind of saying that you think you can trust the scientists to know what to publish or what not to publish. But what about in areas like, like you say, politics, greenhouse gases, or how harmful is fish farming off the East Coast, where the government has a very distinctive stance? And as a representative of the government, your position could be taken to be somewhat out of bounds. I mean, I think I agree with you in the first part that I think science, by and large, should be set free and that we should rely upon with, I guess, legal backups. If I publish the plans for a nuclear bomb and that's considered a dangerous thing to society, I could be sued or arrested for, you know, propagating weapons of mass destruction. But the ability for me to know which is good and which is bad, I guess we tend to give scientists the benefit of the doubt. But what about in areas that are more political in nature?
Well, like, what are we referring to? Like revealing top secret information or something, or what?
No, again, for example, right? Greenhouse gases, is the tar sands, you know, as bad as people say it is? Or, you know, is carbon sequestration a viable technology? That sort of thing. Something where it's more or less, I mean, the science could be questioned, whether it's, you know, is it true or is it not true? Not that the science is falsified, but where the government has a distinctive stance, and this is a person who is employed by the government, do they have a legal or ethical obligation to maintain sort of the party stance as a representative of the government?
I don't think they have an obligation to the party stance. I mean, like, to me, that's a little bit too open-ended, because I mean, your political stance could be almost anything, and unless the scientist in question is also like in the employ of that government agency and being funded by that government agency, in which case you may have like legal ramifications about who owns that information, who owns that science, et cetera, et cetera. Barring that, I don't think that there should ever be any kind of control over what can be revealed to the public if it doesn't, you know, go well with the sort of consensus out of the government. Because again, that just sort of leads in, I think, to some really messy areas of, you know, very real dangerous censorship. So in that case, you know, I think that there absolutely should be no censorship in that particular case.
What about if the scientist is a creationist and he's using his government platform?
Well, I mean, in that case, he's just being wrong. I mean, like, you know, there's no one, there's no legal blockade to stop, you know, a scientist in the employ of the government to come out as a creationist. Once they do, though, I mean, well, now they've announced to the world that, you know, they reject some of the most foundational elements of biology and zoology, you know, quite justifiably, people should be a little bit concerned about, is this person qualified for whatever position they held? But that's the thing, that's a bit of a different situation, I think.
Well, that's interesting, Ethan. And we come back from this commercial, we're going to talk about hairy mice. Well, hairy human mice. Or is it mice with human hair? Or, well, come back after the commercial and we'll have it all sorted out.
And we're back on Radio Freethinker here. So we were talking before the break about sort of the excitement level of a science story versus the content level. And in that particular context, we were discussing, you know, does the excitement level of a story have enough to earn the attention of the public, or do they need some kind of special, you know, in for the story? Well, I found an interesting story that kind of shows us how this analogy might work. So you may have heard that scientists in Japan have made an amazing discovery, a potential cure for baldness. Yes, baldness. So what is this amazing breakthrough?
Comb over?
Yeah, well, yeah, that's what I thought at first. But apparently that has been tried in the past, to little success, I might add. But no, this new study shows that what they've done here is they've taken a bald mouse. I don't know where they found the bald mouse, but anyway, they found one, and they put in stem cells, which regenerated the hair follicles on the mouse, and it actually started to grow back hair. So they cultivated two different kinds of stem cells, and they put them in the mice, and within 3 weeks, 74% of the hair follicles implanted by these new cells started to grow back hair. The hair connected with nerves around the around the tissue and the skin, and they were actually fully functional hair follicles. They weren't like, you know, kind of weird, freaky hair that would fall out right afterwards or anything like that. And they were even able to have hair of different density and color by changing the type of cells they were transplanting into the mouse. So this is really exciting because they also used cells from a human hair follicle. So they grew human hair on this mouse, which is in some ways kind of creepy. But nevertheless, this is a good example because we were talking about the excitement level of a science story. And this is really cool. It's got a lot of markability because it's like a cure for baldness. And then when you read the study, well, you don't read the study, you read the, you know, article in the news, and you go, and you kind of ask yourself, well, great, how does it work?
Magic.
And they're like, well, stem cells and implanting and stem cells and hair. And it's like, there's no real explanation here. It's just like stem cell magic. We made hair grow. And it's, well, it's interesting, but again, it speaks to that kind of, there's not a lot of hard science content in this story. It's more about, you know, here's a rough explanation of what the scientists did, and here is the exciting result. And I think that's a really good analogy to what we were talking about before, about how a science story needs to have that kind of excitement level, but if it lacks that science content, it can kind of fall flat a little bit, which is, I think, a little bit of what happens to this story here.
Well, and you know, it's interesting that this the story you're mentioning has one of the key things I think that any science story should have is it has a link to the original research. Actually, it has a link to several research papers that are related, but to the original research. So if you're reading this and you just sort of want the 1 minute sort of, okay, I get a rough idea, but that's, I don't want to know what stem cells really are for whatever reason. Good, I got a gist of it. Although, again, that can lead to some overhyping, as we've talked about before, about some stories. But if you want to know, well, how true is this? It allows you to follow up. Too many times I have like read articles or stories about science papers, and then I had to go through my own sort of research to find the original article that this was based upon, to research it to see, well, are the claims in the news story actually warranted by the actual science journal? And quite often, you know, as I say, we've mentioned before, you know, scientists cure all cancer. And it's like, well, no, that's not what they said. That's just your spin on it. But it's a very interesting way to adapt the hype of an article to the actual content of it.
Yeah, and especially with something like this that has obviously a very, you know, tangible real-world benefit as well. And the other kind of neat thing that was sort of in the article about the idea that they could sort of customize the hair, like the density and what kind of hair grew, which also kind of runs into an interesting idea. You know how people will nowadays will customize their hair appearance with hair dye and that kind of thing. I mean, imagine if these stem cells were marketable and you could like, you know, oh, I want to have like horse hair today, or I want to have, you know, real green hair for some reason. And these stem cells can make that happen. So well done, scientists. Well done.
It is. It is. When we come back from this commercial, we're going to discover something about the discovery of America. And we're back. Ethan, when were the Americas discovered?
Well, they were never discovered. They were never lost.
I grew up in school, and I remember, at least, you know, in the colonial-minded days, they used to say, you know, in 1492, Columbus sailed the ocean blue and discovered America. I mean, and of course, Europeans probably settled the unpopulated land, as we all know, because there was nobody, well, nobody really here. Okay, so, yeah, horrible thing. Typically, people think that, you know, America was, not sure what the right word would be here for discovered, but you know what I mean when I say discovered. 1492 by Europeans. Thanks to the persistence of the Scandinavians, the sagas of Leif Erikson, etc., and some nifty archaeology, we were able to push back this European discovery of America date to about 1000-ish AD with the uncovering of Viking settlements in the Maritimes. Of course, with the modern benefit of science and paleogenetics in particular, we think the first humans arrived in North America about 14,000 years ago via the Bering Strait. There has been some debate about the number of invasions, the actual method or path that they took, but generally it's accepted, at least for now, that when we refer to the people as First Nations, they are essentially Asian immigrants. So, shifting gears for a second. Ethan, did you hear that the U.S. is reliving World War II by sinking a Japanese ship on the West Coast?
I did not know that.
Yes, well, apparently there's been a drift since the great tsunami of last year, a ship that has only now made it to the North American West Coast. This event helped resurrect the debate amongst anthropologists and archaeologists about the possible, quote, discovery of America by historical Asia. There has long been known that garbage from Japan, China, and the area will travel to North America thanks to the Japanese Current, the Pacific equivalent to like the Gulf Stream. It has also been long conjectured that the Chinese civilization has at some point in the distant past traded with the people of the West Coast here. Now, whether, of course, we mean Chinese, Japanese, Korean, or whatever, from this point onward, I'm probably going to refer to them all as sort of a generic term as East Asian. Sadly, there has been actually little physical evidence to support such a claim, but there has been a noticeable amount of cultural evidence. Now, there have been a number of East Asian artifacts discovered off the West Coast. However, their age, well, age at least of deposit, has been questioned. Some of the artifacts, such as, you know, vases and that sort of thing, do date back thousands of years, although it is possible that these objects actually made their way here via 19th century cargo ships or like what have you. So the archaeological evidence is lacking for this. However, there are some theories out there that use implied cultural contamination between East Asian civilization and American ones. First, some have asserted that linguistic elements of the Japanese can be found in the Zuni people, their tribe in America. That other cultures in Asia, notably the Ainu, which have strong genetic links to First Nations people. The Ainu are off the coast of Japan. It's one of the islands of Japan where these people come from. That they also are use of mortuary poles, or what we would call totem poles, is in these cultures. There are images on Mayan temples and art showing bearded men. This secondary evidence has led people to think that the legend of Fu Sang, a 6th century Chinese legend, could be true, sort of in the same way that the legend of Troy kind of turned out to be true. The story of Fu Sang tells of a tale of a group of missionary monks who set forth to convert America, or the lands on the other side of the Great Eastern Sea, to Buddhism, See, even back then, they had fundamentalists in America. The monks described what could be interpreted as features of America, including tattooed people of the Alouettes, the great rainforests of the West Coast, and mentioning, quote, red pear-shaped fruits, i.e. tomatoes. So this is like a long-standing Chinese folk legend that seems to have some historical credence to what's actually been said. Now, I think logic makes me think that it's quite possible that East Asians came in dribs and drabs to North America. There's no technical reason that they couldn't. However, such trips would have been arduous in the extreme. I remember that this wayward Japanese ship that they just blew up recently took over a year to get here, and most other incidences in the past, and there have been other instances of such ships making it from Asia to North America, usually take over a year to get here, which is not an easy feat to do, especially if you go back thousands of years.
And especially if they're assuming that the people on these ships are somehow staying alive, you know, that they have provisions that are going to last them that long. I mean, it is pretty unlikely that would happen. I mean, it's possible in theory, of course, but it is pretty unlikely.
True. And like I say, also you have this lack of solid evidence, at least so far, which makes me think that such an adventure, like the legend of Fu Sang, could be true, maybe, but like very rare. You know, this odd boat that maybe happened to have made it and made it back as sort of a one-of event. At least enough, you know, like to create legends in North America about these weird bearded men, but that didn't actually leave any genetic anomalies. I did a bit of research, and granted this was my cursory research, into sort of phenotypes and all that, and there's very little connection between sort of the East Asian community and North American community, at least in this sort of more finer grain thing. As they say, there's sort of this great historical link that goes back tens of thousands of years, but not in sort of the more recent past. So what I mean, if there was more mutations or such things, you know, that would end some sort of physical evidence that they may have actually come ashore and lived here for a while, at least introducing the sort of, you know, affliction of. So that doesn't seem to be true. Also, the linguistic links, as I mentioned, some people have claimed that the Zuni tribe in actually New Mexico, which is where they lived, which would be a rather weird place for Japanese to have shown up. But I mean, this linguistic link seems to be rather weak as well. Again, I did some research to check out this particular claim, and they actually have very significant different sort of phenotypes. So, I mean, the actual vowel and consonant sounds they make are not really that similar, although they do have some words that, you know, sort of have a similarity and sort of a classic sense. For example, the Zuni word for clan is kyu, and the Japanese word is kau, which if you saw them spelled out, they sound almost the same, and barring my inarticulate accent, they could sound like that. But again, it's the word clan. Typically, when you're doing linguistic roots, you look for more common words like mother and father and so that. So again, I think this seems quite weak with the link. And I think you agree, Ethan, that the idea of there being at least a significant of cultural interactions between East Asia and North America seems quite dubious.
It's not so much that it's because the transportation is difficult. I mean, it is extremely difficult. I mean, certainly you could have like boats that went along, you know, Northern Asia and made it across to Alaska and then down the coast. I mean, it's not out of the question. I mean, there would have been food available. They could have caught fish. I suppose they could have found ways to get, you know, non-saltwater up there somehow, maybe catching rainwater. So it's not out of the question. The other aspect that we sometimes forget is that had they arrived in, say, a settlement along the West Coast, that would have allowed for communication with the natives living on the West Coast. But it's really unlikely that they're going to go from there to down to Mexico. I mean, even if we assume that, you know, a single native from the West Coast told another native who was living on maybe on the prairies, who told one who was living in, you know, the American prairies, who told one who told a Cherokee, who told, you know, and then we assume that there was this sort of chain of communication. Hey, did you hear about these bearded guys type thing? Even that is really unlikely, because it's still huge, vast amounts of terrain separating these tribes, and who, let's face it, weren't exactly on friendly terms with each other either. So, I mean, it would sort of be like, you know, if we had someone from, you know, China, historic China, create a sort of chainmail-like relationship with somebody in France. I mean, it's conceivably possible, but again, it's not terribly likely. And a lot of the evidence for these sorts of claims, well, they are very interesting. They generally lack any real hard archaeological evidence that you know would sort of be the proverbial smoking gun. It's mostly a lot of conjecture and hypothesis that may not be totally overblown, are not exactly, you know, super strong to begin with, though.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that was my take largely on this particular one. But in my research, I discovered actually a much more plausible link between Asia and America. Did you know that Polynesians settled Hawaii around 550 CE and Easter Island sometime between 500 and 1200 CE? It seems possible to think that they could have continued from something like Easter Island to South America, at least. I mean, there is some supporting evidence for this, which is a lot more solid than what we've discussed so far. So this is not Polynesians coming to North America. This is going to, like, Chile. As it turns out, in 2007, some chicken bones were found in Peru. So what, you might say? Well, it's believed that chickens, not indigenous to the Americas, was actually introduced to our shores by the Spanish invaders in about the 16th century. However, the 2007 bones dated to 1400 CE, meaning that they must have been an alternative source to these fowls. Chickens are common in Polynesia.
I mean, even something like that, though, like, well, that does appear to be sort of like a smoking gun. We have to keep in mind, though, that, you know, it's sort of like the idea of, like, the pottery and stuff that we find where it shouldn't be, for example. There are other explanations for how something like that could have gotten there, you know? Like, somebody could have brought it in a sailing ship. The ship might have crashed. Who knows? The pot might have gotten lost. And, you know, we can have anomalies when we're trying to date something. So, you know, you may get the occasional artifact that they either date it wrong or it's been in a contaminated area that's sort of thrown off the dating process, right?
True. But, well, actually, so the bones themselves seem to be quite credibly dated to that particular period. So I know what you're saying, though, is that there's again, this could have been sort of a fluke anomaly that there was one boat of chickens that came across somehow and they were marooned. But again, the Polynesians did make it to Easter Island, and they had a civilization set up there. So it seems more possible than what you'd got. Again, if the East Asians, like the Chinese or whatever, were sailing to North America, how come they didn't set up a colony on Hawaii or some of these other ones? Also, there's the presence of sweet potatoes in Polynesia. Ethan, as a great scholar of history, I'm sure you must know, the great ramifications that potatoes had to Europe when they were discovered in the New World. The fact that it exists in Polynesia, at least since 1000 CE, at least as an invasive or imported species, depending on your view of agriculture, leads some credibility to the possibility that there was a sort of interplay between at least South America and the Polynesians, at least long before the Vikings did. But, of course, those Asians are, of course, not a great civilization at the time. And I think one of the reasons why we tend to discredit them as being even plausible, even though I think there's a lot more evidence. Again, when I was doing my research for this, there were lots of articles and books and that written to make this sort of Chinese connection about the great Chinese civilization and how they must have been. But I don't know. It seems to me that's almost sort of a form, again, of colonial backwash. When you look at the people who have discovered sort of, you know, America in the past, quite often these books will focus on things like the Chinese or the Romans, you know, could have done it. And these, in an odd sort of way, are acceptable. I mean, they're not as good in a, again, colonial racist sort of way as Europeans, but at least they were imperial. They were like us. So it seems that if anyone else was going to do it, these are sort of, you know, acceptable alternatives. It just seems to be sort of funny that the Polynesians, who seem to have a much stronger claim to do this, are often belied. And I agree with you. the genetic links I had mentioned before, if there were connections between any of the Asians with the North Americans, at least in recent history, there should have been a stronger footprint left in the Americas. But I don't think I'd quite rule it out as heartily as perhaps you are.
Well, I mean, I wouldn't want to rule it out, but I mean, I think that there's a certain amount, we have to be a certain amount of skeptical about this, because even if they did have interaction is not the same as, say, you know, ancient China establishing a temporary colony in North America, for example, right? Like, we can't forget that a lot of trade and a lot of interaction happened purely in ports and happened purely between trading vessels. Like, we know pretty well that the Mediterranean was a hotbed of trade, and that tribes in Africa would go along the coast of Africa up into the Mediterranean and enter into the ports of Rome and Carthage and others and interact with these people. We know it happened. But that's different from, say, like an actual colony arriving and setting up shop. And I think that's one of the distinctions we have to make, is that it is possible that ancient civilizations in Asia were able to communicate in some form, probably via trade with the Native Americans. And it also is quite possible that Polynesians were able to reach it to South America. It probably is actually it's probably reasonably likely that actually could have happened. But it's still it's not quite the same thing as, say, them establishing a colony or a settlement, because that implies, or would imply, but it also requires a considerable presence, an ability to send resources and ships and have continuous contact. And what we do know about the civilizations in Asia was that wasn't really a primary focus for many of them. And there's not a lot of evidence to imply that there was sustained contact, which is really, I think, what would be required to explain some of these sort of cultural oddities, where you have the idea that, you know, there was Chinese influences in Mexico, right? I think in order for that to happen, there has to be a sustained contact that's happening somewhere on the continent, which we just don't seem to see with this evidence.
I think it's interesting, too, in a way, you kind of brought out, I think, two of the biases of a European-type thinking, is this idea of colonization. I mean, the Chinese are quite famous that when they tend to sort of move into an area, they would like tribute from the local population, but they don't colonize, they don't take over, at least not in a major way. And the Polynesians actually will want to set up populations in unsettled areas, which means, of course, if they ever did come to South America, where there is already an indigenous people, maybe they didn't feel like settling in. But I agree, I think it is a unique happenstance that there was some interaction between probably the Asians and the North Americans, but it was far more random and rare than any of these other sort of big theory alternatives seem to point out.
Yeah, I mean, if I were to hazard a guess, I would say maybe once every 100 years at most. Okay. But that's just my estimation.
And I'm sure an excellent estimation. And
thank
speaking
you.
Of excellent estimations, when we come back from this break, we're going to be talking about alternative drug marts.
And we're back on Radio Free Thinker. So we mentioned in our skeptical highlights of last show, there is a rather large lawsuit being brought against the Canadian chain of grocery and drug stores, Shoppers Drug Mart, for $30 million for selling the homeopathic product Acicillium, or Acicoccium, or however you say that. I like Acicillium because it sounds like silly. Anyway.
Well, crap.
Yeah. you can call it that too. Anyway, the lawsuit also names the manufacturer Boron Canada, and I think most of our listeners are probably familiar with that company. The case is being brought by CFI Canada, who sent letters to Shoppers regarding the selling of this ineffective product in January and March of 2012. CFI entered a partner-solicitor relationship with Roy Elliott O'Connell LLP, one of the recognized legal firms that has launched a number of class action lawsuits in Canada most famous for charter cases on provocative issues, including same-sex marriage and euthanasia, privacy and censorship. So, I mean, not surprising that CFI would be chumming with this sort of organization. And it's also not surprising, given that Boron has also faced legal lawsuits in the U.S. In fact, they've spent out about $12 million to resolve similar accusations. So, I mean, this has probably been a long time coming. And given the fact that Shoppers and Boron and other, you know, organizations that have been selling homeopathy have basically, you know, sort of been on notice that, hey, skeptical organizations, not the least the public themselves, do have standards here. And when you sell a product that is essentially water, that is water and sugar, and market it as a flu remedy, you're kind of barking up the tree of a lawsuit, and now they have one. So hooray for that.
Ethan, sorry. So there's this oscillium, right? What is oscillium?
Well, I mean, the homeopathic explanation, of course, would be that it's the essence of duck liver, I believe. Now, I'm not quite sure why they think duck liver would cure the flu. I mean, according to homeopathic logic, what would cure the flu in this case would be little bits of the flu diluted and percussed in the sort of magical homeopathic way, and then administered to a patient. And, you know, the essence of the flu would be imparted to the memory of the water, and through a magical process that I'm actually not trying to be like, you know, ironic here. I really don't understand how this magical process is supposed to work, but somehow it's supposed to cure your flu.
Actually, so I can give you just a little bit of this.
Oh, please do.
So apparently the originator of this particular product was, again, trying to find a cure for the Spanish flu. And in it, he had this idea that there was a certain kind of bacterial that was a causal agent for, you know, things like emphysema, tuberculosis, cancer. And that somehow that this bacterium could be found in Muscovian ducks, in the livers of these ducks. And that's where the sort of duck comes into it. And then, as you point out, once you sort of have this sympathetic magic, if you have a little bit of the substance that causes your illness, it will somehow get rid of the illness. And you do that by the idea of dilution, as you were mentioning. And you can continue with the dilution part.
Yeah, and that's the essence of homeopathy right there, of course, right? Is that, you know, like can cure like when you put it through this sort of magical process. So the way that homeopathy is marketed, and we've talked about this, you know, at length, of course, is that it's not really marketed the way that it's supposedly supposed to work. Like, you don't really see it being marketed as magical water. It's typically marketed as sort of like a herbal remedy or, you know, an item of naturopathy or some kind of alternative medicine, when homeopathy really is its own kind of distinct pseudoscience. And it kind of piggybacks onto the sort of larger alternative medicine, you know, crowd. And it is alternative, of course, but it kind of feeds on that it's a natural, organic, herbal remedy when it really isn't. I mean, it's kind of the opposite, actually. It's sort of like a twisted, you know, false science that involves kind of like magic-y occult power. And if it was marketed the way it actually is, I don't think it would be half as popular as it currently is. I mean, it's one of the most popular forms of alternative medicine. I'm sure it's right up there with, you know, chiropractic as well. So there's a lot of frustration on the part of skeptics that not only, you know, are they marketing this worthless sugar pill as a cure for, you know, the flu, or in extreme cases, even cures for like cancer, heart disease and stroke and all these really serious illnesses, but they're not even marketing it right as homeopathy. They can't even get that part right. And that's really frustrating, because they, like I said, they piggyback on the other sort of alternative medicine bandwagon.
I wonder if that's going to be, so we're going to go more into, you know, what the skeptical lawsuit is about this, but I wonder if, you know, alternative medicine, so herbalists or something, will start suing these people, because, I mean, at least if you're dealing with some sort of, you know, echinacea or some of these other sort of ideas of curatives, there is an actual thing that you are giving these people, whereas the whole premise of homeopathy, besides the whole magical thinking, is it is essentially water, and often sugar water or something flavored water to some point. I mean, in an odd sort of way, I would almost be doubly offended if I was a practitioner of alternative medicine at this, because it diminishes my own particular brand if I was one of those people.
Yeah, that's the thing. Homeopathy, in many ways, is counter to what a normal alternative medicine proponent would believe, because it's actually, it is by definition like including weird exotic chemicals in its product. I mean, they dilute them, of course, but it still involves this kind of like scary chemical, you know, a thing that they often throw at, you know, the pharmaceutical companies, right? But anyway, getting down to sort of the root of the skeptical lawsuit, is part of it is that Boron is accused of breaking consumer protection laws. And so what this means is that they've labeled their products as having properties that is not either scientifically proven or medically established. So saying something like oscillium will cure the flu in you know, 3 to 4 days, or take this medication to decrease symptoms. These kind of statements are to varying levels of degrees regulated by organizations like Health Canada and various consumer protection agencies in Canada and elsewhere. Again, to varying level degrees of success. But nevertheless, when a company puts on any kind of claim like that, whether it's something as benign as the relief of symptoms or extreme as in curing cancer, they need to have some level of scientific evidence to back up that claim. And if they're just selling, you know, snake oil, then that is actually breaking the law. Now, the other problem here, especially that groups like CFI are taking with this, is that this product is being marketed as effective, proven medication, which of course it is not. And the key issue here, of course, is that you know, when someone is sick and they're not feeling well, and they go to their pharmacy and they talk to their pharmacist and they say, "Mr. Pharmacist, I'm not feeling too well. What can you do for me?" And the pharmacist says, "Well, here, take this homeopathic product. It's 15% more expensive than, say, a pharmaceutical company's product, and it'll make you feel better." Well, that's either a lie, or that pharmacist has sort of violated some level of ethical standards, because they're recommending a product that is proven not to work. And there's also that other aspect of it, is that, you know, homeopathy is by and large 15% more expensive than regular medication, and they're upselling you on something that's not even going to work. So there's that double whammy of not only snake oil, but also kind of sleazy marketing as well.
I agree, you know, and it preys upon people who are, you know, trying to look for that quick fix. I mean, especially, you know, for things like the flu and all that. I mean, sadly, we don't really, actually, I guess we do have a cure for the flu and the vaccine, but I mean, things like the cold and all that, you know, there is no real cure out there, and people are just desperate to try it. But once you sort of fall into that sort of hole where you believe one sort of quack claim, then later on, you're much more likely to believe a similar one. So some people would sort of say, well, maybe there's not a whole lot of damage that could be done by someone taking a non-curing cold medicine, because there's none that would have done it anyhow. But these people who buy into this bad thinking are then going to go out, and maybe they do get a real disease, or they have, maybe the cold is turning, could turn into pneumonia, but they don't go to their doctor because they figure, this will cure it for me. And there could be real serious health ramifications from this, which is why, again, we need to sort of be on the bulwark, on the front lines, to sort of make sure that where bad thinking is propagated, especially in areas of trust, like a pharmacy, you know, that we push back against it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's a really key point, because when somebody does go to a pharmacist, they need to get, you know, actually useful advice. And if they do get advice to take homeopathy, that is a serious ethical violation, because, you know, like we said, it hasn't been proven to work. And it could make somebody take homeopathy instead of real science-based medicine. And if they're in a position where that's what they need, then that could delay treatment. It could have drastic implications. So, you know, for skeptics, we really do have to be careful with the sort of infiltration of alternative medicine that hasn't been established or proven to be effective, because there are people out there who they don't know, you know, the difference, and they're going to take a product without realizing that it's not going to help them, and it could delay really important treatment. So a very important issue, and it's a good thing that this lawsuit is happening. It's hopefully it will draw more attention to the issue of homeopathy and alternative medicine. And we'll have to see how this develops for sure.
Exactly. When we come back from our next commercial, you will learn more about skepticism in science. And we're back. Ethan, as you know, we don't really have a high opinion of alternative medicine. That often includes things like, that have been classified as natural or traditional medicine. We tend to deride them as being unproven caltrop. In the famous quote, when traditional medicine claims are shown to be effective, they are no longer traditional, but simply medicine. So traditional medicine is simply sort of that wannabe treatment at best, and outright dangerous at worst. Well, in an odd confluence of aims, Australia has added proof to the dangers of traditional Chinese medicine, although I would not limit it to just Chinese, but any sort of traditional or natural medicine. In an effort to show the power and efficacy of a new DNA reading technique, a team of scientists tested samples of traditional Chinese medicine to find out what was really in them. The technique itself was the one being tested, but what the researchers were doing was they needed some samples so they could show the efficacy of this, and they ended up using these confiscated traditional Chinese medicine. Now, of course, you know, they did sort of prove their first claim that this technique was actually very, very effective and very good, but they actually had some other secondary and very illuminating results. Now, if you are a devotee of traditional Chinese medicine, you may find this interesting and perhaps disturbing. What they saw, I must confess, didn't surprise me, though. A number of concoctions included endangered or threatened species, such as Asiatic black bear and black rhino. And these are sort of ingredients that weren't supposed to be in there, but, you know, they put them in there because there is this, again, sympathetic magic sort of thing. This discovery was not that surprising because a major tenet of Chinese and many other traditional medicine is based upon pre-civilized idea of sympathetic magic. That is, for example, if your junk's in a funk, you ingest the essence of, be it, I don't know, the genitalia or heart of a powerful creature, like a rhino, a bear, or a lion. You will absorb that creature's power. So forgive me for my bluntness, but I mean, that's just stupid thinking. If you believe this, I remind you that plutonium is the most powerful element. Ingest some of that and tell me if your theory really works. Okay, so back to our traditional medicine. As I said, it's sad but not unexpected that some simple-minded people will kill or exterminate a species based upon such bad thinking. There is more to the story than what we normally harp upon as good skeptics. It turns out that those who create such concoctions are not the most ethical people in the world. The DNA testing showed that sort of pure Sangha antelope actually contained goat and sheep parts, so they were doctoring the medicine. Some items included were not listed as ingredients on the label, and they included things like cow and pork. And for those people of a religious bent, this may seem to be a rather inadvertent way of buying your ticket to purgatory. What is more important, though, is that some of these ingredients are actually toxic. For example, ephedra has been banned in Canada for almost a decade now because it causes heart attacks, among other toxic effects. But these were actually also found in these traditional medicines, I guess based on the curiar kilia sort of philosophy. Now, so what's our takeaway from all this? Well, first, as I've mentioned ad nauseum, if it's not medicine, don't take it. You have no idea what it is or what it may really be, and its efficacy, which is usually nothing beyond the placebo effect. And even if you do believe in this woo, this should show you that those who dispense these kind of cures don't really believe them in themselves. They're just in it for the money. And again, another meme you've heard on the show and among skeptics many, many times, although people rail against Big Pharma, Big Alt Med is in it for the money just as much as Pfeiffer is. So grab some skepticism and stop being a patsy. If you feel the need for some woo, grab a bottle of water and remember that almost every animal on Earth has had a molecule of that pass through their body at some point or another. And if you think power could be transferred via this woo, well, let that be your connection. It's better for conservation, safer for you, and won't make you feel like a fool when you find out that the elk penis you bought really was just a wiener.
Well, that is good. But, you know, the sad part about all this is that rare animal species are being driven to extinction to satisfy this this need for obscure ingredients. And it's actually like a really depressing problem that's happening in the world. It actually kind of it makes you wonder, you know, not just about the efficacy of a product, but also the ethical aspect of the product. I mean, if in order to get this product, you have to exterminate a bunch of rhinos. I mean, is that really worth it? I mean, it does raise some disturbing questions.
And as you mentioned, I mean, it's magical thinking to begin with, right? I mean, not only are you sort of committing this natural atrocity, but you're doing it for literally stupid, idiotic reasons. I'm being a little harsh here on this, but for this class of medicine, as I say, the one that's based upon sort of sympathetic magic, you got to be nuts if you really think it believes. Now, herbalists might make claims that, oh, there's something else to it. That's a whole other issue. But driving the species to extinction does not seem to be worth it for your crazy idea.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, I guess we're at the end of this week's show. Ethan, do you have any skeptical highlights?
Yeah, I do, actually. And this one relates to something we talked about on a last week's show with regards to video games. So maybe listeners have heard about the trial that's going on in Norway regarding the shooter Breivik and his claim that he practiced for his rampage by playing violent video games. And this has sort of been plastered all around. It's like a trending news story. And I think it bears some relevance to what we were talking about last week. And I think that one of the things that I would like people to take a look at is look at some of the counter arguments regarding what this person is saying. I mean, this is a guy who was saying that he was going to behead the prime minister and, get rid of all the Islamic people and, you know, these really crazy, wacko things. And then he says that he practiced murdering people by playing video games. And all of a sudden, we run with this story. This is considered, oh, my God, how bad are video games? This is the same idiot, crazy person who thought that, you know, God was speaking to him. Let's employ our skepticism a little bit here and examine how realistic is it that this person was actually able to hone murdering skills by playing Halo or something. So I would encourage listeners to check out some of the, you know, counter arguments about this. There are some pretty good stories out there, like on Boing Boing. And if you look on some other websites that are a bit more tech friendly, you may find some counter examples about why this statement that he was practicing on video games is actually quite ludicrous. So I encourage listeners to check that out.
Yep. Sounds really interesting. And as any good skeptic, you should always do your own research into anything you hear, even by brilliant people like the ones you're currently listening to. So I have two skeptical highlights, and actually these two pair so very, very well, because when I read the initial sort of blurb about them, I thought, ah, this is either crazy or this is genuine. And then when I did my little research underneath, I discovered the exact opposite. So Ethan, did you know that there is going to be a sort of forum or discussion that's titled, Is Bin Laden Really Dead? What do you think that would be about?
Well, are they suggesting that Bin Laden is not really dead?
Exactly. When I saw that, I said, oh, God, you know, it hasn't even, what's been a year, not even a year now. And already they're coming up with these sort of, you know, cornball theories about how he's not really dead or whatever. But no, I went and I checked it out. And it's actually part of the Philosopher's Cafe. It's moderated by Martin Hunt. And actually, the question is, how do you verify remote events? The idea is that, you know, Bin Laden was killed way over in Pakistan. How could I, as a good skeptic and sort of person, say that he really is dead? And there's a whole philosophical debate about those kind of claims. So it's not as crazy as it sounded when I first read sort of the title. Now, this is going to happen April the 25th at 7 p.m. at La Zupa, which is in North Van. Again, links will be on our webpage. And then I had another one that looked kind of interesting until I did a bit more research. This is Orthomolecular Medicine Today. The International Society of Ortho Medicine is having its 41st annual convention, and they're going to talk about orthomolecular medicine, endocrinology, cardiology, psychiatrics, pediatrics, and this was the part that I said, oh, this has got to be a good thing, evidence-based medicine. So then I went and I did my little check and research, and orthomolecular research is that sort of mega vitamin type therapy that, you know, if you just had the right diet, all of your problems would go away. One of the most famous ones being Linus Pauling, who is famous for telling everyone to have 50 billion milligrams of vitamin C every day, who is a, I believe, is a Nobel doctorate, but it's in physics, and these are all, of course, medical claims. So as it turns out, this seems to be one of your classic, well, I don't know how completely woo it is, but it is definitely on the fringe group and definitely alternative medicine. Now, they're also having a big, like I say, this conference. It's at the Fairmont Hotel in Vancouver, the 27th to 29th. But, of course, again, because they're alternative medicine, they're not in it for the money. No. Tickets, $545.
Wow.
Now, of course, that's probably the whole complete package. You can, it does have $20 to $500, so there's probably an introductory that you can go for $20, but wow.
Yeah, that is a lot of money. Go to TAM instead. Well, we are out of time on today's Radio Free Thinker. This is Ethan, your free thinking historian, saying thanks for listening.
And this is Don saying, eyes open, minds on.
If you wish to make an apple pie from scratch, you must first invent the universe.
Thanks for listening to Radio Free Thinker. Remember to visit us online at radiofreethinker.com and subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. If you have any local skeptical events you would like us to mention on the air, email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
Venture to the stars. A still more glorious dawn awaits, not a sunrise, but a galaxy rise. A morning filled with 400 billion suns. The rising of the Milky Way. The cosmos is full.